This is New America Now, dispatches from the new majority. I'm Sandeep Roy. Coming up, looking for a job in a recession? How about in healthcare?
Healthcare is traditionally a recessionary, it's not recession-proof, but it's recession-resistant.
Mammograms and the cultural divide.
Well, you know, it's probably nothing. It's probably just a bola de grasa, a ball of grease.
The double whammy of drought and recession in the Central Valley.
And so people are actually pretty desperate right now. There are people starving right now in the Central Valley.
First, these stories from the ethnic media.
Comedia, I'm Odette Keeley. This week, more African-American veterans are homeless, and legislators tighten abortion funds. The health care reform bill is headed to the Senate. In order for it to pass the House, Democrats were forced to make concessions on insurance coverage for abortions. Lawmakers who oppose this amendment want to reverse it in the Senate. The editorial board of El Diario La Prensa newspaper in New York agrees. They published an editorial denouncing the House amendment. Metro editor Ava Sanchez says this amendment will seriously hurt Hispanic women.
Basically, what the amendment that the House like recently passed does is like tighten a ban against using like federal funds to pay for abortions. Basically, what it does is like it bans the proposed new government health insurance plan from covering abortions, except in three cases, rape, incest, and where the life of a mother is threatened. And it also like imposes the same restrictions on policies paid with federal subsidies from private insurance. So we hope it will be defeated in the Senate, because for us what it means is that a woman like seeking abortion coverage will have to buy like separate insurance policy with their own money. And we believe that in the case of poor women, many of them Latinas, that is just not going to happen because they are not going to be able to afford it.
Aside from that, what do you believe are the major implications or effects of such an amendment on women, especially Hispanic women?
I think statistics show that already like one in four women living in poverty who want to choose an abortion can, because the laws already prevent like federal tax dollars from covering abortions. And we believe that millions of poor women will simply not have a choice to have an abortion if the amendment prevails in the Senate.
One of the assumptions that people make, Eva, about the Latino community is that it's predominantly Catholic. So abortion coverage is something that they wouldn't even consider. Do you think then that this is something that wasn't necessary to have an editorial about it?
I think it's necessary because, you know, the issue that many Latino women live in poverty and, you know, are not going to be able to afford an abortion if they choose to do that is important. And then it's true that many Latino women are Catholic, but it's also true that the Latino woman face also the issues that make having a choice, this choice, like important. Like, for example, the rates of pregnancy among teenagers are really, really high among Latinas. And the issue that, you know, many of Latino women now are in this vulnerable population doesn't have means to pay for health coverage makes it, like, really important not to, you know, pass an amendment that is going to limit the ability of this poor woman to, you know, have the choice if they choose, you know, to have an abortion.
Did the editorial board of El Diario La Prensa have any apprehension that you might alienate some Catholic readers?
For us, the issue is so important that we really thought it was the right thing to do. And, you know, we really wanted to put a light on this issue and, you know, make clear that if this amendment, like, is passed also by the Senate, it's going to have, like, a disproportionate negative impact among Latino women. Organizations like the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health and other like Latin organizations in New York, actually they are against the amendment. And, you know, some of our maybe Catholic readers, you know, are going to be like upset about us, like, being like against the amendment, but I think we believe that is the right thing to do.
Eva Sanchez, Metro editor for El Diario La Prensa in New York, the oldest Spanish language daily in the country. It's also the number one Spanish language daily in the city, with a print circulation of 50,000. The Afro-American Newspapers reports on the latest study of homeless Americans by the National Alliance to End Homelessness, a prominent advocacy and research organization in Washington, D.C. Executive editor Taliba Shikwandu was shocked by the ethnic breakdown of the estimated 131,000 homeless war veterans.
About 45% of those were African-American, so just slightly under half. Like 60,000. Some of the statistics surprised me in general. I didn't realize that the percentage of African Americans veterans that were homeless were equivalent to the percentage of African Americans that were homeless. That part I found extremely interesting. But I am always stunned by the number of veterans that are homeless, the people who have gone out and they said, okay, I'm going to give part of my life to the service of what is about protecting this country, whether they serve in another country or whether they only serve here. That I find it incredibly interesting that they would be homeless, that we don't have a better system in place to help them.
What did experts say are the major reasons why so many of these African-American veterans become homeless?
Well, high unemployment rate. African-American unemployment is significantly higher than any other group in the country right now, and so that is in fact something that is going to impact African-American veterans. There's a disproportionately high rate of discharge from prisons and foster care systems with regards to veterans who are African-American.
What did this study cite as the major cities in the U.S. where many of these homeless veterans can be found?
California, New York, and Texas are some of the biggest places where they have the highest number of homeless people per capita.
Do you think that this report is on the radar of President Obama and that the government will do something about it?
I think this report is on the radar of President Obama. Now, it's a separate question whether the government will do something about it. This isn't new. I mean, these numbers are going up, but they've been high for years.
This report actually came out 2 years ago, and this is the third year it's been updated. And it's been saying similar things all along.
And the curious timing is just days after the president announced he wanted to stop homelessness in the next 5 years, this report came out. Do you think then that this will impact his goal?
I have, from listening to the president, I believe that making things better for our veterans is among his more immediate priorities on a great many levels, in terms of making things better for their families while they are deployed, as well as making things better for them when they return. So I think that under the auspices of working with veterans, I think that, yes, those numbers, those things might see more immediate be addressed. As for homelessness in general, I think that, again, as he addresses the problem in general, those homeless veterans will be part of that.
What has been the feedback of the readers of your paper, the Afro newspaper group, on this report?
Well, the feedback we've gotten so far has largely been kind of a shock at the numbers, and from veterans saying we need people to do more, and they aren't wrong.
Taliba Chikwandu, executive editor of the Afro-American Newspapers, distributed in the Washington, D.C. metro area. It's the longest-running family-owned black newspaper in the nation, with a circulation of about 100,000. These stories and other news from the ethnic media can be found on our website, newamericannow.org. I'm Odette Keeley.
healthcare reform has dominated the headlines all year. But the cultural issues around healthcare extend far beyond public option and private insurance. Today on New America Now, the healthcare challenges of California. California is struggling to find enough primary care physicians and nurses for its population. And as Californians age, it's going to get tougher. And as Californians get more diverse, it becomes tougher still to find doctors who match the population. But it's not just doctors and nurses. A new study by Beacon Economics finds a looming crisis in the hidden healthcare workforce, or allied healthcare. That's people like x-ray technicians, dental hygienists, and physical therapists. Brad Kemp was lead researcher of the study and is regional research director for Beacon Economics and joins us from his office in Los Angeles to explain what's going on. Thanks for joining us, Brad.
Thank you for having me.
Why did you all decide to focus on this allied healthcare field?
Well, we certainly understood that, you know, the aging population, not only in California, but in the U.S. overall, driven primarily by baby boomers, was going to have a heavy effect across a broad spectrum of industries, but no more affected than in the healthcare sector. And when we were initially contacted by an agency that was looking to understand the effects on healthcare, we felt it was a worthy cause and something that we felt we could help out with. And it seems to the study was a great opportunity for us.
Well, Californians age 65 and over will double in the next 20 years. Can you paint for us a little picture of what we are headed towards with the current situation in allied healthcare? How big is the gap?
Well, the gap is large. Let me give you a way of representing it is by 2030, one out of every three allied health jobs will have to be filled by an out-of-state worker. Now, that sounds, I suppose, reasonable to some degree, maybe to some people, but we don't feel that way. We feel this is an opportunity for Californians that it's being missed. Because healthcare is traditionally a recessionary, it's not recession-proof, but it's recession-resistant. It rarely shows any downward trend across history. It's pretty much grown along with population. And not only growing with population, but the aging of that population. And so, therefore, it's incredibly important for us to get that opportunity for training inside the state of Californians for Californians to fill that job.
So why?
I mean, let's put it this way. The number of certified allied healthcare jobs by 2030, in 2010, we're expecting 317,000 total certified allied healthcare. Now, when I say certified, these are jobs that require some type of training to get in the job. It's around 52% of all allied health employment. If I was to tell you that there's 605,000 in 2010, just total allied health, and then of that, 317,000 requires some type of certified training. And obviously, we're not going to really come anywhere near the number that we need in the end to meet that demand.
So when we say allied healthcare jobs that require training and ones that don't, can you give us an example?
Sure. You know, obviously, a physical therapy assistant is somebody that has to have training in physical therapy. They do require a certification to actually work on the job. Versus, in some cases, somebody working in the lower level home health care aide does not require any type of certification, and therefore, there is no barrier to entry. So all Californians are eligible for those positions. But as I talked about the certified allied health employment, you're talking about now the necessity of post-secondary education to be involved. And that's where we see the real limits.
So right now, there is this growing demand for these kinds of jobs. You're saying that there will be way more jobs out there than there are people in California who can fill those jobs. Why are these positions becoming harder to fill?
It's purely a limit of the training programs. I mean, we've got plenty of Californians to fill the jobs. The question is, do we have plenty of certified Californians? And that's a limit of the training system to be able to provide the number of workers necessary. And in this case, we found a serious gap. And it's not only a gap that's new. It's a gap that exists today that is only going to grow and get worse. It's similar to the nursing shortage that we experienced in the 90s. It's not a matter of willing applicants or people that want to get those jobs. It was a problem of huge long lines to get into RN programs, and that's true in allied health as well. These certified programs have waiting lists to get into them. That means that there's plenty of applicants, but there just aren't enough spaces to get all those people trained.
And there are waiting lists because community colleges, which might offer some of these programs, are facing budget cuts and offering less. Is that what's going on?
That would be conjecture on my part at this point. I mean, I haven't actually asked each individual site, but I think that's a reasonable conjecture that there's budget limitations. There may also be a lack of understanding in terms of the need to expand these programs to meet the future supply. I know that the part of the problem in the nursing field was it's hard to get somebody to leave the nursing floor where they make more money to go into education. That was a big limiter in being able to expand nursing programs. I'm not sure. We're talking about a big swath of occupations here, and I'm sure the problems within each occupation training is different, according to each occupation.
And is cultural and linguistic competency going to be important in this field as well, or do we just need the numbers?
Are you kidding? Of course it's going to be important. I mean, we've got one of the most culturally diverse populations. That's going to continue to diversify. To be able to provide services to those individuals, whatever language services they need, is going to be critical in the healthcare field. So therefore, the workers serving that general population should represent the same diversity as the population itself.
You know, I was reading in the report that organizations like La Clinica de la Raza is partnering with community colleges to train medical assistants. What kind of solutions are you seeing out there?
Well, I, at this point, I'm concerned about there not being enough solutions. Let me start by saying that. But it's a critical piece of this. We need public-private partnership. And why I say that is not every training provider here is going to be a community college. And they're not. We've seen that in the data. There's a lot of private providers as well. But there's going to have to be a public or governmental push to make this happen. I mean, obviously, that's where this kind of money is going to have to come from. And I think it's going to be critical for, it's no different than right now what's happening in a number of different industries with our workforce investment boards. Workforce investment boards are basically training agencies or agencies that provide customized training based on employer needs. And what we need is more partnerships between employers, hospitals in this case, and ambulatory services to be working with local providers to create customized programs to meet their growing demand. I think this study helps hospitals, ambulatory care, and long-term care facilities to understand the type of growth and demand that they're going to see into the near future.
So the silver lining in all of this is that this is an area with jobs. It is a bright spot in our recession.
I think healthcare is always a bright spot in a recession, and I say that understanding that, unfortunately, people continue to get sick. That's not stopped by recession, so the demand remains high, and that means that employment remains constant. These jobs are good-paying jobs. They're living wages, and they're a great opportunity for Californians should they be given the opportunity and the ample training necessary to take those positions.
Thank you for joining us, Brad.
My pleasure.
Brad Kemp of Beacon Economics is the lead researcher in the study of the allied healthcare shortage in California. You can find links to the study on our website, newamericanow.org. This is New America Now. I'm Sandeep Roy. Become a friend on Facebook. Just search for New America Now Radio. With one in four Californians foreign-born, one of the biggest issues in healthcare is how do you communicate health problems across language and cultural divides? Often, family members have to step in as interpreters. But commentator Eugenia Chen says that can be a fraught decision.
Months ago, my father was diagnosed with prostate cancer. Cancer is terrifying enough, but the way my parents learned about the diagnosis was the most shocking part of our experience. After his biopsy, Dad met with his urologist, who's also from Taiwan. Even though my parents speak English reasonably well, it was comforting to know that they have a Chinese-speaking doctor. As a reporter, I've written a lot about the importance of language access in healthcare situations. But none of that was useful when my family was facing a serious illness. The language we needed the most was compassion. But it was something we didn't get that day. At the doctor's office, the urologist gave his diagnosis. "But don't worry," he said casually. "You can find a lot of information about prostate cancer on the internet." "What can we do?" my parents wanted to know. The doctor told them that surgery is an option, but he didn't bother explaining the many different types available. He didn't mention that some surgeries can help minimize incontinence and sexual dysfunction. He didn't talk about surgeries that can minimize blood loss. Instead, he vaguely told them about traditional surgery, which makes a large incision in the lower abdomen. It's an extremely invasive procedure, usually for patients with late-stage tumors. "Well, what about radiation?" my dad said. "Oh, sure," the doctor said. "You can get radiation implants, like what Rudy Giuliani did." "Well, if it's good enough for Rudy Giuliani." Without another word of explanation, the doctor signaled that it was time for my parents to leave. Not knowing what else to do, my parents asked if they should still keep their plans of going to Taiwan in 2 weeks. "Sure, enjoy your life," the doctor said. "After all, you're only at stage one." Whenever I think about this experience, all I can hear is my mother's voice over the phone, indignant with anger. "We didn't even know what stage your dad's cancer was at, and the doctor didn't even tell us until we were leaving." Although he's not a cancer specialist, the urologist could and should have at least outlined some of the treatment options. If he couldn't do that, he should have at least directed my parents to an oncologist who could fully explain the options. My parents knew nothing about prostate cancer that day, and nothing about where to go after hearing this terrible news. Making sure that my parents had a Chinese-speaking doctor and telling them about their right to medical interpreters seemed completely pointless. I thought that a Chinese-speaking doctor would naturally be gentler, at least kinder, to his fellow immigrant patients. I was completely wrong. With the help of friends, we eventually found a top cancer hospital where the staff helped my parents navigate through the maze of treatment plans. After a surgery to remove his prostate, my dad now is cancer-free. Many immigrants face language and cultural barriers when they seek healthcare, but another barrier in healthcare, more systemic and less visible, is the lack of the universal language of compassion. Having a Chinese-speaking doctor is a benefit, but without compassion, it gives no comfort at all.
Eugenia Chen runs the blog Muni Diaries and is a contributor to New America Now. You're listening to New America Now, dispatches from the New Majority on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Sandeep Roy. For more stories, visit us on the web at newamericanow.org. We know our lettuce and walnuts and raisins might be coming from somewhere in California's Central Valley, the state's breadbasket, but we know little about the men and women who work in those fields in the baking sun. Some may be underage, some may be as old as 70, many are undocumented. And in the middle of a drought and a recession, as fields lie fallow, they are in desperate straits. Don Villarejo started as a volunteer in the farm workers movement in 1976 and founded the California Institute for Rural Studies. He's the author of the book Suffering in Silence and has won the National Service Award of the Office of Migrant Health from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Don Villarejo, thanks for coming on the show.
Delightful to be here.
For those of us who haven't been to the fields of Central Valley, what would we see if we went there?
Depends on whether you stayed on the freeways, where you would mostly see urban development, subdivisions sprawling, and so forth. If, on the other hand, you got off into the side roads and went out to the fields where you would see vast, vast areas where there were plantings of different kinds, of fruit trees, for example, nut trees like almonds. But you'd also see vast open areas where nothing is growing right now because of the factors that you describe. We have had a drought. But we've also had environmental policy decisions in the courts that have reduced irrigation supplies beyond what the drought has done. So there are hundreds of thousands of acres that are now fallow. An acre is about the size of a football field, So if you can imagine 200,000 football fields where nothing is growing, whereas in the past we have been producing vegetables and other kinds of agricultural commodities. So it's a barren area in many parts, particularly of the West San Joaquin Valley.
And what's happening to the people who are working in the fields in those areas? Where are they going?
There's no work. And they have already been pushed as far back as one could imagine in terms of trying to survive. There are what we used to call bread lines, or now food giveaways, every 2 weeks on a Tuesday in Mendota. People line up, 1,000 or more, every 2 weeks to get a little package of food to try to get through. Many of the workers are not eligible for unemployment insurance because they don't have documents. And so the kinds of things that most Americans think they can rely on in times of unemployment and difficulty are not available. No welfare, no support systems at all. And so people are actually pretty desperate right now. There are people starving right now in the Central Valley.
And what are the biggest health problems for people working in those fields?
The health problems are very complex. As many people are aware, we have a consciousness now around obesity and eating right and so forth. But if you're very poor, you want to spend money that gives you the maximum amount of calories per dollar. And those tend to be high-fat foods. They tend to be foods that we know contribute to obesity, to diabetes, and other problems that are in our communities. So what we have is a peculiar situation where we have a very much higher prevalence of obesity, a very much higher prevalence of diabetes, and other chronic health conditions in this population than in the general population as a whole. And that's a really serious issue. But if people don't have money, they can't afford to buy tomatoes, lettuce, and the other kinds of things that we know are more healthful.
And I was reading a report you'd written, and I was struck by the fact that, you know, you expect things around problems relating to heat, problems relating to pesticide use or exposure to pesticides. But you also documented something about persistent stomach aches among people because they were required to taste the unwashed grapes.
Yes. This is in the Coachella Valley. 10 years ago, when we first started interviewing workers there, we were unaware that this was an issue. But those grapes come off in May or June. They're the first grapes harvested in California. And the whole point of harvesting them early is to bring a sweet-tasting grape to market as early as possible and command a higher price. And the way in which the employers try to determine whether a particular bunch of grapes are ready for harvest is to insist that the workers taste them. And this is in the fields where they've been sprayed with pesticides, where there's dust, there's all kinds of bacteria around, and they're not given an opportunity to wash those grapes. We found an association between the testing of grapes for sweetness by workers and the prevalence of intestinal disorders, stomach aches, diarrhea, things of that nature. This doesn't prove that that's the actual cause, but is a definite association, and it needs to be explored further. But the workers really told us, and we had no idea before we went in, that they were being forced to do this by their employer, and the consequences are apparently pretty severe.
There was a story that came out earlier this year. I think one of the Telemundo affiliates did it of a young woman who was probably underage who had collapsed and died on the fields
yes.
in the intense sun. How common are things like that?
They're not very common, fortunately, but we have had a prevalence of heat stroke fatalities, not only in California, but in other states, North Carolina, for example, that led the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, to issue a morbidity mortality weekly report issue devoted specifically to heat stroke among agricultural laborers in the United States. And California and North Carolina were the two states with an unusually high prevalence. Part of this is due to the heat waves we had in 2007, for example. There was a persistent heat wave in the Central Valley. There was also one in 2005. And other people, other than workers, died. But we've had quite a number of these cases. And what we want and what we would like to see is both enforcement of rules that require the employer to provide drinking water, to provide shade, to provide rest breaks. And it gets a little complicated because if a worker is paid so much money for each bucket of tomatoes they harvest, then the more buckets they harvest, the more they will earn. And so taking a rest break doesn't look very attractive. Or drinking a lot of water, which would eventually require them to go use a toilet facility, which is some distance away, would also interrupt their work. So it's a little bit complicated. And how we deal with that as a society, I think, is one of the difficult health and safety issues right now that we face. We would like to see better enforcement. We would like to see stricter rules, and we would like to see an opportunity to maintain people's health in those difficult conditions.
And how are people's health affected by the fact that they might be undocumented? You mentioned they obviously can't get things like unemployment and things like that. But are there other ways in which their immigration status is affecting their health?
Not directly, but there are indirect ways. So, for example, if someone is experiencing difficulty working in a temperature of 110 degrees in the sun in the Central Valley, working very fast to harvest tomatoes, and they're undocumented, they're very reluctant to complain. They're very reluctant to call a government agency and ask for enforcement if, for example, there's no drinking water provided or if there's no shade provided. And that has to do with their immigration status. So they will take risks that are otherwise, for most people, not something that you would even consider to being a problem. The woman who died, Maria Jimenez, in May of 2008, was 17 years old and pregnant, and she had not taken water for the entire day, and she was undocumented. I don't know if that made a difference. Maybe it did. Maybe there was a question of whether she would have work if she complained or if she went and asked for water. I don't know. But that's a way in which this problem works itself out. In addition, most people who are undocumented don't have access to health care. There is no way that Medi-Cal will provide for people who otherwise would qualify based on income the opportunity to get health care through that system unless you're pregnant. And then in that event, you do get emergency Medi-Cal. But even there, you have to apply for it and you have to deal with government agencies and so forth and so on. So there are ways that it does affect health. Fortunately, most of the workers are young and they're in good health when they come here and they can get through seasons like that.
So what do people do when they fall sick?
A variety of things. In some cases, they use home remedies. In some cases, they will simply do without. In the investigative work we did, when we looked at a cross-section of about 1,000 workers statewide, we found a gentleman who had had a broken shoulder working with livestock out in the Central Valley of California. He had not had it treated, a broken shoulder, untreated. Why? Well, his employer told him not only would he lose his job, but his brother and both of his cousins would lose their job. In addition, they would lose their housing, which had been supplied by the employer. So that undocumented status really threatened in very serious ways the whole family's livelihood and where they could live. And so he went without treatment of a broken shoulder. That's unacceptable.
And you did a survey, I think, back in 2000 of farm laborers. And did you find was insurance being offered at all by some of the larger employers?
Yes. About 16%, one out of six employers, offered health insurance. However, there were co-payments for the premium that the worker had to contribute. And as a result of that, only about 60% of the workers who had an opportunity to get health insurance through their employer took advantage of that because the others felt they didn't have the resources, they didn't have the money to be able to contribute that portion of the premium. So altogether, perhaps 11%, one out of nine workers, had health insurance through their employer. But most workers had no health insurance of any kind, not Medi-Cal, not through their employer, not through any private provider. Most workers had nothing.
But they're young, as you said, and so for the time being, maybe they're able to get by. But have we done studies to figure out just the occupational illness? Is it causing chronic health problems that are further down the line?
By all means. Particularly back injuries are very prevalent. It's stoop labor. People, after 5 hours of leaning over and working as rapidly as they can to grab cucumbers and put them in a bucket, after a while, you have serious back problems. And so we find that after 20 years of that kind of work, fully half of the workers have had a job injury that has prevented them from working. And that's pretty serious. That's a very high prevalence, 50% injury rate that prevented people from continuing work.
And does the notion of what is a household there affect the issue in terms of, because we tend to measure so many things in terms of households, and the notion of household is very different down there.
Yes. In fact, we had very interesting discussions with a group of workers that we recruited before we began the survey in which we asked that very question, what is a household? And because there are many instances where unaccompanied men and two-thirds of the undocumented men are here without any family member. They're here alone. And so they tend to live together, often in housing provided by an employer or a labor contractor. And we found as many as 21 individuals living in a single dwelling. And the measure of household is whether they share rent, share the purchase of food, and share other normal expenses like utilities and so forth. And that's how a household was defined in our study. And we found many, many cases. 40% of the workers live with an unrelated person, and about 20% of the workers live with five or more unrelated people. So it's like being in college, if you will, when you have lots of roommates, but you don't know what their background is and who they are and so forth. It's a very unusual circumstance. We have nothing like it in the work world outside of agriculture.
In 1990, the U.S. Surgeon General promised that for the first time, the health and safety of all those who work in the nation's farms would be a high priority of federal programs. What was done, and was anything that was done, is it affecting these people who might be undocumented and working in California's fields?
Yes and no. There was a lot done. An initiative was put forward by the Surgeon General of the United States. And it resulted in, through Congress, an appropriation for research and intervention on the farms of the United States. Most of that money, however, was allocated to address problems of farm operators and their family members. Children of farmers, for example, who die on the farm because they're run over by tractors or other kinds of accidents. And that's a very serious problem. There are literally, 100 or more children a year who die on farms and their parents are farmers or ranchers. And so addressing that is a significant issue. However, relatively little money was allocated specifically to address the issues facing farm laborers. Some money was, and some interesting work has come out of it. For example, at the University of California at Davis, there is an agricultural health and safety center that focuses primarily on hired workers. Right now, in the community of Mendota in western Fresno County, there's a project now in its fourth year looking at the health of about 850 families in that community, following them for up to now a four-year period. And the intention is to continue to follow them and track their workplace experience, the experience in the environment of the community, as well as personal behaviors, diets, and so forth, and try to understand the factors that contribute to various kinds of health issues.
So what are the big health issues now, especially because of the drought, the water shortage, and the recession?
Well, the main kinds of things we see, I think, are the chronic health conditions that I described, obesity, diabetes, things of that nature. But we haven't really measured, I think, with any kind of accuracy or reliability, mental health outcomes that are associated with those kinds of stressors. We know in other populations, people who live in cities, that if you're under severe economic stress, it's not unusual to take up drink. You might smoke more. You might even try recreational drugs, anything to escape from the pressures that you're feeling. And that goes on in these communities of the Central Valley as well. In fact, we know that there's quite a bit of drinking among the men in this population. But we really don't understand the mental health as well as we need to. And one of the things that I've been talking with the Department of Labor about this year is how we might add to future surveys of farm laborers a good instrument that begins to look at mental health and examine those issues. And perhaps we need to have in our community clinics psychologists who can help with workers. And it's complicated because they have to, deal with multilingual folks. In some cases, folks who don't speak Spanish, they may speak an indigenous dialect like Mixtec or Zapotec or Trique. And unless you're familiar with the cultures and familiar with the community, it could be very difficult to get sort of the kind of interaction you want in that kind of a session for therapy.
No, there are all these healthcare proposals that are being debated in Congress. They're all going to try and exclude people here without papers.
That's right.
So will any of them, whatever passes, have any effect on these farm workers of California?
If there are U.S.-born children in these households, or if there are some family members who are legal permanent residents, those folks will be able to get health insurance through the programs that are being discussed. So that's one plus. It's a small plus. It's not what we want. We would like to see everybody covered because a lot of the folks who don't have insurance are undocumented and working here without any provision. My hope is, and this is a hope, and I think that we have a little bit of confidence that it may happen, is that next year, not in 2009, but in 2010, immigration reform will come to the fore. I look forward to President Obama's speech in State of the Union in January. I think it's possible that he may raise the possibility then that we're going to seriously address immigration reform. And if we do, and if we do it right, then the present immigration status of so many folks who will be excluded from the health care programs could change. And it could change in a way that they, too, would have access to health insurance.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Sandeep.
Don Villarejo is the author of the book Suffering in Silence, and he founded the California Institute for Rural Studies. You're listening to New America Now. I'm Sandeep Roy. For more stories, visit us on the web at newamericanow.org. Anyone can be vulnerable to breast cancer, but it seems that cancer prevention is based on who we are and how we live. Ethnicity may be a factor in whether women go for regular mammograms or not. That's according to a new study from UCSF multidisciplinary team, including my guests, Drs. Rena Pasek and Nancy Berg. They looked at the role culture plays in the decision of Latina and Filipina women to get a mammogram. Their conclusions appear in the October issue of the journal Health Education and Behavior. Rena Pasek and Nancy Berg, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rena Pasek, why did you want to focus on Latinas and Filipinas for this study?
Much of the work that has been done trying to understand how to encourage women to get mammograms originated in research that targeted middle-class Anglo women. And much of our theory, the body of theory that guides our work in health communication and health education, derive from studies such as that. And my colleagues and I, however, have been working in the diverse communities of the San Francisco Bay Area for almost two decades, and really came to see that the lessons from that mainstream body of research really didn't apply and didn't help guide us as we went into the communities and tried to help women learn about mammography.
Well, can you give an example of where the studies failed you?
Well, the studies really addressed a set of beliefs that if, for example, the prior research showed that if you told women that they're susceptible to breast cancer and that mammograms can benefit them by finding the cancer early. So these are very linear kind of cognitive, you know, scientific information. If you take the scientific information about how to avoid death from breast cancer and you give it to women very directly, why, of course, they'll run right out and get their mammograms. And we were seeing that that actually wasn't the case in communities where we were working, like with Latina women, Filipina women, even Chinese, African American, many communities.
Well, you know, that intention to go in for a mammogram, as you say, that sounds a fairly straightforward decision. But Nancy Berg, it seems like from the study, it isn't a straightforward decision at all.
No, it's not. For example, as Rena said, the studies will ask, public health studies, for example, using survey-based methodologies, will ask, are you confident that you can get a mammogram? And oftentimes women will say yes. And they'll ask something like, well, are you confident that you can make the time in your day to get a mammogram? Women will say yes, but that's not necessarily what they're concerned about. They're concerned, oftentimes in our study we found, about their immigration status. When they go into the clinic, are they going to be asked if they're legally here? Are they going to be asked for a Social Security number? So those were the kinds of concerns that were actually influencing women's willingness to come in.
And it was also about who was doing the asking.
Yes, yes, that's definitely true. One of the findings from this study is the importance of the relationship that women have, not only with their providers, but also with outreach workers. We found that women were more interested in talking to friends, family members, people that they knew and that they trusted when thinking about making medical decisions, such as getting a mammogram.
So a white lab coat and the authority that it brings doesn't necessarily translate you into you going out and doing it during your path.
Right. There's an issue of credibility. And for me, I was raised in, you know, sort of mainstream home, and I had the benefit of a higher level of education. And so to me, science is a source of credibility. But to many people, what's credible is someone who cares about you. And if the information is not coming from a caring and welcoming source, if it's coming from a healthcare system that's really alien to you and intimidating to you, that's not going to be as credible as information that comes from, say, a community health outreach worker. We see those individuals having enormous power and influence in terms of educating people and helping them take on preventive actions and behaviors because the women trust them. They can see that they care about them.
But it's not even that the women are necessarily intimidated by the doctor. You know, when I read the study first and found that there were a lot of women who say, yes, they'd take the test and then they wouldn't do it, that's not necessarily that surprising. But what I was surprised was that they weren't at all intimidated by the doctor. It was just that they didn't necessarily have a relationship with that doctor.
I think it's a combination, but you're right. If they don't feel that the doctor cares about them, for example, we had some of the women we interviewed, one of the stories that comes to my mind was that there was a patient who was receiving a diagnosis of cancer from the doctor, and they came away and said, I didn't even know that doctor. How could that doctor tell me something so personal, so important? So you're right. It wasn't just the intimidation factor. Again, it was that we refer to it as relational culture, where people prioritize close relationships over most other sources of information and other priorities.
So, Nancy Burke, when they do decide to go in for a mammogram finally, what is the push?
Well, it depended, you know, for different women, different reasons. One of the interesting things that we found was that even though women were inclined, for example, if they found a lump, to go in for a mammogram, the first thing they did was not to call their doctor. It was to talk to their family, their community, and to...
Was that easy to do? You know, is it easy to talk to your children, for example, about a lump in your breast?
Well, they weren't talking to children. I mean, they were talking to, for example, one of the women that we interviewed was a director of a community-based organization that served Latino youth. She found a lump, and she went to the women that she had talked with when her own children were sick, who had given her advice on how to squelch a fever, for example. And they had told her, well, you know, it's probably nothing. It's probably just a bola de grasa, a ball of grease. You know, first drink some teas, go talk with Doña, I'm just going to say Teresa, and get a massage. It's probably just something she can work out. So she ended up delaying her mammogram for several months, doing these other things first, even though she was, as she identified herself, very well educated. But she felt she didn't want to know. And so she decided to do these other things first.
But along the same vein, but with a very different result, we also saw examples of women who would come to get a mammogram because the community health outreach worker wanted them to, but they really didn't understand mm-hmm. that the procedure they were going for was designed to find cancer in their body, which is really a very counterintuitive thing. You know, we don't really want to rush out and find those cancers in our body. However, many of us can get past that to realize that we, by finding it, if it's there, we're going to save our lives. But it is a very counterintuitive thing. So these relational issues can cut both ways.
Exactly. And I think another, just an addendum to that, is that many of the interventions that are designed to reach women, to bring them in for mammograms, are based on the assumption that there is trust in information, in biomedical information, that there's trust in science, and that there's there's trust in the healthcare system that it's going to treat them well. And most women's experiences are very different than that. And so those assumptions don't actually work. And that's where the relational part is very important.
And is it also a lot about just poverty, that if I'm not in pain, I'll skip this test?
Certainly. We saw that in many ways, shapes, and forms. And it also is all tied up with the fact that in a relational type culture, women will, in those kinds of instances where they have to prioritize, they will put the other members of the family first without question. They won't hesitate to bring their children in for immunizations. But for themselves, that's a different matter. They won't go. They'll only go if they're extremely sick.
The other piece to that is really recognizing that there's a wider context that's influencing women's decisions. And a lot of it has to do with their experiences for immigrant women with healthcare in their home country. And for many of the women that we interviewed, preventive care was not on the radar. For many women, it was. And actually, they did engage in preventive care in their home country. But when they got here to the Bay Area, there were some barriers that made it very difficult
to access
care, from being feeling somewhat isolated, relying on family members with whom they had a strained relationship for travel to the healthcare center, things like that. So there are many different factors that play.
And I can also imagine that often, especially if there are language issues, mm-hmm. if you're relying on children or family members to do the translating, to talk about your breasts is not comfortable.
Exactly. And this is another place where the health worker model is extremely important. And we're lucky that in the Bay Area, we have navigation services in many health clinics that do help with issues such as this.
What are navigation clinics?
Well, navigation services are people who work in clinics that help bring women through the services. So, for example, at San Francisco General, at the Avon Center, they have patient navigators who are fluent in Mandarin, Cantonese, Spanish, and they actually bring women through the process and help them with logistical issues as well as the understanding what's happening as they're going in for a screening or a diagnostic mammogram.
Now, your study looked at Latinas and Filipinas. Both mm-hmm. communities are very much tied to the church. And I was curious, did you find, were they religious overtones to the choices these women made?
Oh, definitely. Religion is so powerful in the lives of so many women, and it has to do in some ways with the way they think about health in general. To me, in the way I was raised, health is due to germs, and cancers are due to exposures to different substances and mutations in, you know, genes. But to other people, the concept of health is made up of very different things, and it can have to do with many women talk to us about ill health being the result of bad things they did in the past. And, you know, they are not too far off, because science is showing ways that things like stress, there is a physiologic pathway that's being better and better understood between stress and cancer. But for many women that we spoke to, these were the causes of illness, and that's how they thought about health.
And you say that because of religion, many of these women might look at issues of disease differently than most people do. But does that mean that if you think that my cancer is caused by something bad I did before, does it mean also that there's a lot of taboo stigma associated with the disease, which would make people hesitant to go and discover it within themselves?
Yes. I mean, I think that there are variations on that theme. I mean, there's definitely stigma associated with cancer that we found in many of our studies. The interesting piece that I found in our study related to religion was that women talked about religion in ways that it supported them, and it was actually a mechanism for getting what they needed through their religious communities. They found out, they learned of different resources. When in the hospital, they had, you know, so many people coming from their religious communities to visit them that they felt that they were treated better in the hospital than if they hadn't had these folks coming to visit. But in the literature, in the public health literature, oftentimes religion is talked about as
a fatalistic orientation, or the source of a fatalistic orientation. And for the women in our study, that was just not the case. I mean, we might have heard one or two people saying, well, it's really up to God. But they were also the same women who were doing so many things to make sure that they were taking care of their own health and that of their family.
And what about their daughters? Because you interviewed mother-daughter pairs.
Yes.
What did you learn from that?
This was a colleague of ours on our study, Pamela Washington, who's currently a doctoral student at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. And she found that there are a great array of different dynamics that occur between mothers and their adult daughters, particularly in immigrant populations where the mother may herself be an immigrant, the daughter was born in the U.S., and so the daughter would be relied upon for help with the doctor, for help understanding health information. And so the daughter could really be a pivotal, very instrumental person in helping bring the mother in for mammography, but not in all cases, because if there is a tense relationship, for example, between the mother and daughter, the daughter isn't the ideal vehicle. In our field, we tend to look for, or we have tended to look for, absolute rules, you know, that we can follow. And I think our research really helped open up this world of complex dynamics that doesn't abide by any of the rules that we had been learning, you know, in graduate school. And so we really have to pull back and go to the community members themselves and understand from them what is the best way to help them learn about these services that really can be life-saving for them.
And so you are developing a postdoctoral program at the UCSF Cancer Center, right?
Well, right now that's an idea that we have. We do know that we need to have more researchers doing research on health communication and health behavior from the immigrant and diverse and African-American communities. And so we do have a training program that seeks to encourage master's students who are from those ethnic communities to go on for their doctoral degrees and to pursue careers in research. And that we've had that program now for 11 years and have almost 80 people who have gone on for doctorates. So we're really hoping to literally change the face of research in my field, which is one that where culture has really not been understood and has been sort of pushed to the side. And we feel that it's really front and center in understanding how to help people with their health and behaviors that are so important for positive health. And it'll be very exciting when these folks finally emerge as leaders in the field and are doing their own research. We're going to see a lot of different kinds of programs and efforts in health promotion.
Well, thank you for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Zarina Pasek and Nancy Burke are part of a multidisciplinary team from UCSF. Their study of Latina and Filipina women's decisions to get a mammogram appears in the October issue of the journal Health Education and Behavior. Thanks for listening to New America Now, dispatches from the new majority, interethnic, international, and intergenerational news for the new America. Now you can follow us on Twitter. Just search for New America Now. And if you'd like to know more about the music you hear between interviews on the show, become our friend on Facebook. Just look for New America Now Radio. New America Now is also available as a podcast. Go to newamericanow.org. Our engineer and technical producer is Eric Wayne. Mary Ambrose directs the show. New America Now is produced at the KALW Studios in San Francisco by New America Media. Thanks for joining us. I'm Sandeep Roy.